or defecate. When Shin made his first bathroom request after his release from prison, his teacher said no. Shin tried to hold it during the school day, but ended up peeing his pants a couple of times a week, usually when he and other students were working outside. Since it was winter and very cold, he worked in pants stiff with urine. Shin had known most of his classmates since they were 7 years old and started primary school together. He was smaller than most of the boys in his class, but they had usually treated him as a peer. Now, taking their cue from the teacher, they began to taunt and bully him. They snatched away his food, punched him in the stomach, and called him names. Almost all the names were elaborations on reactionary son of a bitch. Shin is not certain whether his classmates knew he had betrayed his mother and brother. He believes that his childhood friend, Hong, did not tell anyone. In any case, Shin was never teased for having betrayed his family. That would have been an unpatriotic and risky schoolyard taunt, since all students were under orders from teachers and guards to inform on their families and on each other. Before his time in prison, Shin had managed to make a strategic classroom alliance. He had become friends with Hong Ju-hyun, the grade leader. This was the job Shin had tried to win on the night he snitched on his family. Hong led students on work details and was authorized by the teacher to hit and kick classmates he regarded as shirkers. He was also the teacher's most trusted informer. Hong himself could be beaten or denied meals if the class dithered during field work and failed to meet quotas. His position was similar to adult prisoners who worked as crew managers. Guards gave these managers, who were always male and tended to be physically imposing, virtually unchecked authority over their fellow prisoners. Since the managers had to answer for any failures by their crews, they were often more vigilant, brutal, and unforgiving than camp guards. After Shin's mother and brother were executed, Hong began to watch Shin carefully. During a road repair assignment, he noticed that Shin had loaded far too many stones in a handcart. Shin tried again and again to push the cart, but it was too heavy for the emaciated boy to budge. When Shin saw his grade leader approaching with a shovel, he initially expected some help. He thought that Hong would order other students to pitch in and roll the cart. Instead, Hong swung his shovel and struck Shin in the back, knocking him to the ground. "Pull your handcart correctly," Hong said. He kicked Shin in the side of the head and told him to stand up. As Shin struggled to get to his feet, Hong again swung his shovel and mashed Shin's nose, which began to bleed. After that beating, students who were younger and smaller than Shin began to insult his mother. With the encouragement of the teacher, they called him names and punched him. Owing to his confinement in the underground cell, Shin had lost much of his strength and nearly all of his endurance. His return to hard labor, long hours, and skimpy meals at school made him almost insanely hungry. In the school cafeteria, he scrounged constantly for spilled cabbage soup, dipping his hand in cold, dirty soup that had spilled on the floor and licking his fingers clean. He searched floors, roads, and fields for grains of rice, beans, or cow dung that contained undigested kernels of corn. On a morning work detail in December, a couple of weeks after his return to school, Shin discovered a dried-up ear of corn in a pile of straw and devoured it. Hong Ju-hyun was nearby. He ran over to Shin, grabbed him by the hair, and dragged him to their nearby teacher. "Teacher, instead of working, Shin is just scavenging for food." As Shin fell to his knees to beg for forgiveness, a ritual abasement that he performed as a matter of instinct, his teacher hit him in the head with his walking stick and shouted for the rest of the class to help punish the scavenger. "Come here and slap him," the teacher said. Shin knew what was coming. He had slapped and punched many of his classmates in a round robin of collective punishment. Students queued up in front of Shin. Girls slapped him on the right cheek, boys on the left. Shin believes they went through 5 rotations before the teacher said it was time for lunch. Before his confinement in the secret prison, and before his teacher and schoolmates began picking on him, Shin hadn't thought to blame anyone for his birth inside Camp 14. His blinkered existence kept him focused on finding food and avoiding beatings. He was indifferent to the outside world, to his parents, and to the history of his family. As much as he believed in anything, he believed the guards' preaching about original sin. As the offspring of traitors, his one chance at redemption and his only way of averting starvation was hard work. Back at school, however, he bristled with resentment. He was not yet hobbled by guilt about his mother and brother. That would come much later. but his months in the cell with Uncle had lifted, if only slightly, a curtain on the world beyond the fence. Shin had become conscious of what he could never eat and never see. The filth, stink, and bleakness of the camp crushed his spirit. As he became marginally self-aware, he discovered loneliness, regret, and longing. Most of all, he was angry with both his parents. His mother's scheming, he believed, had triggered his torture. He blamed her, too, for the abuse and humiliation dished out by his teacher and classmates. He despised both his mother and his father for selfishly breeding in a labor camp, for producing offspring doomed to die behind barbed wire. Out on the execution grounds, in the moments after Shin's mother and brother were killed, Shin's father had tried to comfort the boy. "You okay? Are you hurt anywhere? Did you see your mother in there?" his father asked repeatedly, referring to the underground prison. Shin was too angry to reply. After the execution, he even found it distasteful to say the word father. On his rare days off from school, about 14 days a year, Shin was expected to go see him. During the visit, Shin would often refuse to speak. His father tried to apologize. "I know you're suffering because you have the wrong parents," he told Shin. "You're unlucky to be born to us. What can you do? Things just turned out this way." Suicide is a powerful temptation for North Koreans plucked out of ordinary lives and subjected to the labor camp's regime of hard labor, hunger, beatings, and sleep deprivation. Suicide was not uncommon in the camp, Kang Chol-won wrote in his memoir about the decade he spent inside Camp 15. "A number of our neighbors took that road. They usually left behind letters criticizing the regime, or at the very least its security force. Truth be told, some form of punishment would await the family regardless of whether or not a critical note were left behind. It was a rule that admitted no exceptions. The party saw suicide as an attempt to escape its grasp, and if the individual who had tried the trick wasn't around to pay for it, someone else needed to be found." North Korea's National Security Agency warns all prisoners that suicide will be punished with longer sentences for surviving relatives, according to the Korean Bar Association in Seoul. In his memoir about 6 years in two of the camps, Kim Young, a former lieutenant colonel in the North Korean army, says the appeal of suicide was overwhelming. "Prisoners were beyond the point of feeling hungry, so they felt constantly delirious," wrote Kim, who said he spent 2 years at Camp 14 until he was transferred across the Tadong River to Camp 18, a political prison where guards were less brutal and prisoners had slightly more freedom. Trying to end the delirium he felt in Camp 14, Kim said he jumped down a coal mine shaft. After tumbling to the bottom of the mine, badly injured, he felt more disappointment than pain. "I regretted that I could not find a better way to really put an end to this indescribable torment," he wrote. As wretched as Shin's life became after the execution of his mother and brother, suicide for him was never more than a passing thought. There was a fundamental difference, in his view, between prisoners who arrived from the outside and those who were born in the camp. Many outsiders, shattered by the contrast between a comfortable past and a punishing present, could not find or maintain the will to survive. A perverse benefit of birth in the camp was a complete absence of expectations. And so Shin's misery never skidded into complete hopelessness. He had no hope to lose, no past to mourn, no pride to defend. He did not find it degrading to lick soup off the floor. He was not ashamed to beg a guard for forgiveness. It didn't trouble his conscience to betray a friend for food. These were merely survival skills, not motives for suicide. Teachers at Shin's school rarely rotated to other jobs. In the 7 years since he had entered school, he had known only two teachers. But 4 months after the execution, Shin caught a break. One morning, the teacher who tormented him, and who encouraged his classmates to do likewise, was gone. His replacement gave no outward indications that he would be any less abusive. Like nearly every guard in the camp, he was a nameless, bullish-looking man in his early 30s who demanded that students avert their eyes and bow their heads when they spoke to him. Shin remembers him being just as cold, distant, and domineering as the others. The new teacher, though, did not seem to want Shin to die of malnutrition. By March 1997, about 4 months after his release from the underground prison, starvation had become a real possibility for Shin. Harassed by his teacher and fellow students, he could not find enough nourishment to maintain his weight. He could not seem to recover from his burns. His scars still bled. He grew weaker and often failed to complete his work assignments, which led to more beatings, less food, more bleeding. The new teacher took Shin to the cafeteria after mealtimes. He told the boy to eat whatever leftovers he could find. He sometimes sneaked food to Shin. He also assigned him less arduous work and made certain that Shin had a warm place to sleep on the floor of the student dormitory. As important, the new teacher prevented Shin's classmates from hitting him and stealing his food. The taunting about his dead mother ended. Hong Ju-yun, the class leader who had struck him in the face with a shovel, again became his friend. Shin put on some weight. The burns on his back finally healed. Perhaps the teacher felt pity for a picked-on child who had watched his mother die.
It is also possible that senior guards in the camp had found out that a disgruntled teacher was mistreating a reliable snitch.
Perhaps the replacement teacher was ordered to keep the boy alive. Why the new teacher made the effort, Shin never had a clue. But Shin is certain that without his help, he would have died. Chapter 10, Working Man. Tractors hauled food to the worksite every day. There were heaps of milled corn and steaming vats of cabbage soup. Shin was 15 and working alongside thousands of prisoners.
It was 1998, and they were building a hydroelectric dam on the Tadong River,
which forms the southern border of Camp 14. The project was urgent enough to warrant filling the stomachs of slave laborers three times a day. Guards also allowed workers, about 5,000 adult prisoners and a couple of hundred students from the camp's secondary school, to catch fish and frogs from the river. For the first time in his life, Shin ate well for an entire year. The North Korean government had decided that the camp, with its high-voltage fence and factories that churned out military uniforms, glassware, and cement, needed a reliable local source of electricity and fast. "Hey, hey, hey, it's falling, falling!" Shin shouted the warning. He was hauling platters of wet concrete to the crew when he noticed that a freshly poured concrete wall had cracked and was beginning to collapse. Beneath it, a crew of eight was finishing another wall. He screamed as loudly as he could, but it was too late. All the workers, three adults, along with 3 15-year-old girls and 2 15-year-old boys, were killed. Several were crushed beyond recognition. The supervising guard did not halt work after the accident. At the end of the shift, he simply ordered Shin and other workers to dispose of the bodies. The mountains of North Korea are crisscrossed with swift rivers, large and small. Their hydropower potential is such that 90% of the electricity on the Korean peninsula prior to partition came from the north. But under the Kim family dynasty, the North Korean government has failed to build or maintain a reliable national electricity grid linked to hydroelectric dams, many of which are located in remote areas. When the Soviet Union stopped supplying cheap fuel oil in the early 1990s, city-based, oil-powered generators sputtered to a halt. The lights went out across much of the country. Most of the time, they are still out. Satellite photographs of the Korean Peninsula at night show a black hole between China and South Korea. There is not enough power in the country even to keep the lights on in Pyongyang, where the government tries to pamper the elite. In February 2008, when I traveled for 3 days and 2 nights to Pyongyang as part of a large delegation of foreign journalists to cover a performance by the New York Philharmonic, the government managed to turn on the lights in much of the city. When the orchestra and the press left town, the lights went out again. It makes sense, then, that the construction of small and medium-sized hydroelectric plants, capable of serving local industry and built mostly by hand using basic technology, has been a priority since the 1990s. In a frenzy of hard labor, thousands have been built. Besides staving off economic collapse, the dams are ideologically beguiling to the family that runs the country. As his hagiographers tell the story, Kim Il-sung's most important intellectual achievement, his brilliant Juche idea, asserts that national pride goes hand in glove with self-reliance. As the great leader explained it, establishing Juche means, in a nutshell, being the master of revolution and reconstruction in one's own country. This means holding fast to an independent position, rejecting dependence on others, using one's own brains, believing in one's own strength, displaying the revolutionary spirit of self-reliance, and thus solving one's own problems for oneself on one's own responsibility under all circumstances. None of this, of course, is even remotely possible in a country as ill-governed as North Korea. It has always depended on handouts from foreign governments, and if they end, the Kim dynasty would probably collapse. Even in the best of years, it cannot feed itself. North Korea has no oil, and its economy has never been able to generate enough cash to buy sufficient fuel or food on the world market. North Korea would have lost the Korean War and disappeared as a state without the help of the Chinese, who fought the United States and other Western forces to a stalemate. Until the 1990s, North Korea's economy was largely held together by subsidies from the Soviet Union. From 2000 to 2008, South Korea propped up the North and bought itself a measure of peaceful coexistence with huge, unconditional gifts of fertilizer and food, along with generous investment. Since then, Pyongyang has become increasingly dependent on China for concessional trade, food aid, and fuel. A telling measure of China's growing influence is that in the months prior to Kim Jong-un's official emergence in 2010 as the chosen successor to Kim Jong-il, the ailing elder Kim traveled twice to Beijing, where diplomats say he asked for China to bless his succession plan. Reality notwithstanding, North Korea champions self-reliance as the sine qua non of the country's much-advertised goal of becoming a great, prosperous, and powerful nation by 2012, the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung. To that fantastical end, the government regularly enlists the masses in miserable tasks dressed up in noble slogans. The propaganda can be quite creative. The famine was repackaged as the Arduous March, a patriotic struggle that North Koreans were encouraged to win with the inspiring slogan, "Let's eat two meals per day." In the spring of 2010, as food shortages again became severe, the government launched a massive Back to the Farm campaign to persuade city dwellers to move to the countryside and raise crops. These urbanites were to be permanent reinforcements for rice planting combat. The annual campaign that sends office workers, students, and soldiers to the countryside for 2 months in the spring and 2 weeks in the fall. In the winter, city people are charged with collecting their feces and that of their neighbors for spring planting. Other urgent and patriotic tasks that North Koreans have been urged to shoulder include, let's breed more high-yielding fish, let's expand goat rearing, and create more grassland in accordance with the party, let's grow more sunflowers. The success of these hortatory campaigns has been mixed at best, especially when it comes to the government's highly unpopular efforts to lure city-bred people into backbreaking farm labor. For the dam project inside Camp 14, there were no such problems with motivation. As Shin witnessed it, soon after guards announced a new rally of endeavor to build a hydroelectric dam, thousands of adult prisoners marched from factories to makeshift dormitories erected near the north bank of the Taedong. Shin and his classmates moved out of their school dormitory. They all worked, ate, and slept at the dam site, located about 6 miles southeast of the center of the camp. Labor on the dam, which satellite photographs show to be a substantial concrete structure spanning a wide river with turbines and spillways hugging the northern bank, went on around the clock. Trucks hauled in cement, sand, and rock. Shin saw only one diesel-powered excavator. Most of the digging and construction was done by workers using shovels, buckets, and bare hands. Shin had seen prisoners die in the camp before, of hunger, illness, beatings, and at public executions, but not as a routine part of work. The greatest loss of life at the dam occurred soon after full-scale construction began.
A rainy season flash flood rolled down the Taedong in July 1998,
sweeping away hundreds of dam workers and students. Shin watched them disappear from a perch on the riverbank where he was hauling sand. He was quickly put to work confirming the identities of dead students and burying their bodies. On the third day after the flood, he remembers carrying the bloated body of a girl on his back. At first it was slack, but it soon became stiff, with rigid arms and legs splayed outward. To squeeze the body into a narrow, hand-dug grave, he had to push the limbs together. Floodwaters stripped some drowned students of their clothes. When Hong Ju-hyun, discovered a naked classmate amid the post-flood debris, he removed his own clothes and covered the body. As the cleanup continued, Shin competed with many other students to find bodies. For each corpse they buried, guards rewarded them with one or two servings of rice. The Taedong, as it flowed past Camp 14, was too wide and swift to freeze in the North Korean winter, which allowed dam construction to continue year-round. In December 1998, Shin was ordered to wade into the river's shallows to pick up boulders. Unable to bear the cold and without the approval of his guard, he joined several other students who tried to wade out. "You come out of the water and I'll starve you all, understand?" their guard shouted. Shivering uncontrollably, Shin kept working. Students worked primarily as bottom-rung laborers. They often carried steel reinforcing rods to older workmen who tied them together with twine or wire as the dam rose from the riverbed in a checkerboard pattern of concrete blocks. None of the students had gloves, and in winter their hands sometimes stuck to the cold rods. Handing over a rebar sometimes meant ripping skin from one's palms and fingers. Shin remembers that when one of his classmates, Byun Soon Ho, complained about a fever and feeling unwell, a guard gave him a lesson in the benefits of stoicism. "Soon Ho, stick out your tongue," the guard said. He ordered the boy to press his tongue to a freezing rebar. Nearly an hour later, Soon Ho, tears in his eyes, his mouth oozing blood, managed to detach his tongue. Working at the dam was dangerous, but Shin also found it exhilarating. The primary reason was food. It was not particularly tasty, but month in and month out there was lots of it. Shin remembers mealtimes at the dam site as the happiest moments of his teen years. He regained all the weight and stamina he had lost in the underground prison. He could keep up at work. He became confident in his ability to survive. Living near the dam also gave Shin a small measure of independence. In the summer, hundreds of students slept outdoors under a canopy. When they were not working, they could walk, during daylight hours, anywhere inside the sprawl of Camp 14. For his hard work, Shin earned a recommendation from his grade leader that allowed him to leave the dam site for 4 overnight visits to his father. Since they were not reconciled, Shin spent just one night with him. He had worked at the dam for about a year when his time at secondary school came to an end in May 1999. The school had been little more than slave quarters, from which he was sent out as a rock picker, weed puller, and dam laborer. But graduation meant that, at age 16, he had become an adult worker. He was ready to be assigned to a permanent job inside the camp. About 60% of Shin's class was assigned to the coal mines, where accidental death from cave-ins, explosions, and gas poisonings was common. Many miners develop black lung disease after 10 to 15 years of working underground. Most miners died in their 40s, if not before. As Shin understood it, an assignment in the mines was a death sentence. The decision about who went where was made by Shin's teacher, the man who 2 years earlier had saved Shin's life by providing him with extra food and halting abuse from his classmates. The teacher handed down assignments without explanation, curtly telling students where they would spend the rest of their lives. As soon as the teacher made his announcements, new masters, foremen from camp factories, mines, and farms, came to the school and led students away. The teacher told Hong Ju-hyun that he was going to the mines. Shin never saw him again. The girl who lost her big toe in the mines at the age of 11, Moon Sung Sim, was assigned to the textile factory. Hong Sun Jo, the friend who saved Shin from his torturers by confirming that he'd informed on his mother and brother, was also sent to the mines. Shin never saw him again either.
If there was a rationale behind the assignments, Shin never understood it.
He thinks it came down to the personal whim of the teacher, who is consistently unreadable. Perhaps the teacher liked Shin. Perhaps he pitied him. Maybe he had been ordered to look out for the boy. Shin just doesn't know. In any case, the teacher again saved his life. He assigned him to a permanent job at Camp 14's pig farm, where 200 men and women raised about 800 pigs, along with goats, rabbits, chickens, and a few cows. Feed for the animals was grown in fields surrounding the livestock pens. Shin In-gun, You're assigned to the ranch, the teacher told him. Work hard. Nowhere else in Camp 14 was there so much food to steal. Chapter 11. Napping on the Farm. Shin did not work hard. The foreman would sometimes beat him and other workers who performed poorly, but not seriously and never to death. The pig farm was as good as it got for Shin at Camp 14. He even sneaked the occasional mid-afternoon nap. Mealtime portions in the farm's cafeteria were no larger than at the cement factory, the textile mill, or the mines. Nor was the food any better. But between meals, Shin could help himself to ground corn intended for the piglets he fed between November and July. Out in the fields where he weeded and harvested from August to October, he snacked on corn, cabbage, and other vegetables. On occasion, the foreman would bring a cooking pot out to the fields, and everyone could eat his or her fill. The farm was located up in the hills, away from the river, about a half-hour's walk from Shin's former school and the house where he had lived with his mother. Women with children walked back and forth to the farm from family housing, but most of the farm workers stayed in a dormitory on the farm. Shin slept there on the floor in a room for men. Bullying was not a problem. He did not have to fight for a warm patch of concrete. He slept well. There was a slaughterhouse on the farm where 50 or so pigs were butchered twice a year exclusively for guards and their families. As a prisoner, Shin was not allowed to eat pork or the meat of any livestock raised on the farm, but he and other prisoners could sometimes steal. The smell of roasting pork on the farm would alert guards, leading to beatings and weeks of half rations, so they ate purloined pork raw. What Shin did not do on the farm was think, talk, or dream about the outside world. No one there mentioned the escape plan that had led to the execution of his mother and brother. Guards did not ask Shin to snitch on fellow workers. The anger that overwhelmed him in the wake of his mother's death receded into numbness. Before he was tortured, confined in the underground prison, and exposed to Uncle's stories about the world beyond the fence, Shin had been uninterested in anything beyond his next meal. On the pig farm, that passive blankness returned. Shin uses the word relaxing to describe his time on the camp farm, which lasted from 1999 to 2003. Outside the camp during those years, life in North Korea was anything but relaxing. Famine and floods in the mid-1990s all but destroyed the centrally planned economy. The government's public distribution system, which had fed most North Koreans since the 1950s, collapsed. As a panicked response to hunger and starvation, barter trade ran wild and private markets exploded in number and importance. 9 out of 10 households traded to survive. More and more North Koreans sneaked across the border into China for food, work, trade, and flight to South Korea. Neither China nor North Korea released figures, but estimates of these economic migrants range from tens of thousands to 400,000. Kim Jong-il tried to control the chaos. His government created a new network of detention centers for traders who traveled without authorization. But with crackers and cigarettes, they could often buy their freedom from hungry police and soldiers. Rail stations, open-air markets, and back alleys in major towns became crowded with starving drifters. The many orphan children found in these places became known as wandering sparrows. Shin did not yet know this, but grassroots capitalism, vagabond trading, and rampant corruption were creating cracks in the police state that surrounded Camp 14. Food aid from the United States, Japan, South Korea, and other donors mitigated the worst of the famine by the late 1990s. But in an indirect and accidental way, it also energized the market ladies and traveling entrepreneurs who would give Shin sustenance, cover, and guidance in his escape to China. Unlike any other aid recipient in the world, North Korea's government insisted on sole authority for transporting donated food. The demand angered the United States, the largest aid donor, and it frustrated the monitoring techniques that the UN World Food Program had developed around the world to track aid and make sure it reached intended recipients. But since the need was so urgent and the death toll so high, the West swallowed its disgust and delivered more than $1 billion worth of food to North Korea between 1995 and 2003. During these years, refugees from North Korea arrived in the South and told government officials that they had seen donated rice, wheat, corn, vegetable oil, non-fat dry milk, fertilizer, medicine, winter clothing, blankets, bicycles, and other aid items on sale in private markets. Pictures and videos taken in the markets showed bags of grain marked as a gift from the American people. Bureaucrats, party officials, army officers, and other well-placed government elites ended up stealing about 30% of the aid, according to estimates by outside scholars and international aid agencies. They sold it to private traders, often for dollars or euros, and delivered the goods using government vehicles. Without intending to do so, wealthy donor countries injected a kind of adrenaline rush into the grubby world of North Korean street trading. The lucrative theft of international food aid whetted the appetite of higher-ups for easy money as it helped transform private markets into the country's primary economic engine. Private markets, which today supply most of the food North Koreans eat, have become the fundamental reason why most outside experts say a catastrophic 1990s-style famine is unlikely to happen again. The markets, though, have not come close to eliminating hunger or malnutrition. They also appear to have increased inequity, creating a chasm between those who have figured out how to trade and those who have not. In late 1998, a few months before Shin was assigned to the pig farm, the World Food Program conducted a nutrition survey of children, which covered 70% of North Korea. It found that about two-thirds of those surveyed were stunted or underweight. The numbers were double that of Angola, then at the end of a long civil war, and the North Korean government became furious when they were released to the public. 10 years later, when private markets in the North were well established and selling everything from imported fruit to Chinese-made CD players, nutrition in state-run institutions for children and the elderly had barely improved, according to a World Food Program nutrition survey that was tolerated by the government as a condition of receiving aid. The children looked very sad, very emaciated, very pathetic, a nutritionist who worked on the 2008 food survey told me. She had participated in previous nutrition surveys dating back to the late 1990s and concluded that chronic hunger and severe malnutrition had persisted in much of North Korea despite the spread of markets. International nutrition surveys have also found a pervasive pattern of geographic inequity. Hunger, stunting, and wasting diseases are 3 to 4 times more prevalent in remote provinces of North Korea, home to the hostile classes, than they are in and around Pyongyang. As Shin found in the labor camp, the most secure place for powerless North Koreans to live amid chronic hunger is a farm. By all indications, farmers, excepting those whose land was ruined by floods, weathered the famine far better than city dwellers. Even though they worked on cooperative farms where crops belonged to the state, they were in a position to hide and hoard food, as well as to sell it for cash or trade it for clothing and other necessities. The government had little choice after the famine, after the collapse of its food distribution system, and after the rise of the private markets, but to offer farmers higher prices and increase incentives to grow more food. Private farming on small plots of land was legalized in 2002. This allowed more private farm-to-market trade, which increased the power of traders and the autonomy of productive farmers. Kim Jong-il, however, never warmed to market reform. His government called it honey-coated poison. It is important to decisively frustrate capitalist and non-socialist elements in their bud, according to the Rodong Sinmun, the party newspaper in Pyongyang. Once the imperialist ideological cultural poisoning is tolerated, even the faith unshakable before the threat of a bayonet will be bound to give in like a wet mud wall. The capitalism that bloomed in the cities and small towns of North Korea weakened the government's iron grip on everyday life and did little to enrich the state. Kim Jong-il grumbled publicly, saying, "Frankly, the state has no money, but individuals have 2 years' budget worth." His government counterattacked. As part of the military first era that Kim's government officially proclaimed in 1999, the Korean People's Army, with more than 1 million soldiers to feed 3 times a day, moved aggressively to confiscate a substantial slice of all food grown on cooperative farms. At harvest time, Soldiers bring their own trucks to the farms and just take, said Kwon Tae-jin, a specialist on North Korean agriculture at the Korea Rural Economic Institute, which is funded by the South Korean government. In the far north, where food supplies are historically lean and farmers regarded as politically hostile, the military takes a quarter of total grain production, Kwon said. In other areas of the country, it takes 5 to 7%. To make sure that workers at state farms do not shortchange the military, the Army stations soldiers at all 3,000 of them throughout the harvest season. When tens of thousands of city dwellers are brought to the farms to assist with the fall harvest, soldiers monitor them to make sure they do not steal food. The permanent deployment of soldiers on farms has spawned corruption. Kwon said that farm managers pay off soldiers, who then turn a blind eye to large-scale theft of food that is later sold in private markets. Disputes among groups of corrupt soldiers periodically lead to fistfights and shootouts, according to a number of defectors and reports by aid groups. Good Friends, the Buddhist aid group with informants in the north, reported in 2009 that one soldier on a state farm was stabbed with a sickle during a fight over corn. Sealed away on the pig farm, Shin heard nothing about the street trading, corruption, and extra-legal inner-city travel that would, in less than 2 years' time, help him escape. Holed up on a mountaintop that was a kind of camp within the camp, he drifted uneventfully through the last of his teenage years, keeping his head down, his mind blank, and his energies focused on stealing food. His most vivid memory of those years was getting busted for barbecuing stolen pig intestines. He was beaten, deprived of food for 5 days, and his cafeteria rations were cut in half for 3 months. Turning 20 on the farm, he believed he had found the place where he would grow old and die. But the pig farm interlude ended abruptly in March 2003. For reasons never explained, Shin was transferred to the camp's garment factory, a crowded, chaotic, stressful worksite where 2,000 women and 500 men made military uniforms. At the factory, Shin's life again became complicated. There was relentless pressure to meet production quotas. There was renewed pressure to snitch. Guards scavenged for sex among the factory's seamstresses. There was also a newcomer, an educated prisoner from Pyongyang. He had been schooled in Europe and had lived in China. He was to tell Shin about what he was missing.
Chapter 12. Sewing and Snitching. 1,000 women stitched together military uniforms during 12-hour shifts. When their temperamental, foot-powered sewing machines broke down, Shin fixed them. He was responsible for about 50 machines and the seamstresses who operated them. If the machines did not spew out their daily quota of army uniforms, Shin and the seamstresses were forced to perform bitter humiliation work, which meant 2 extra hours on the floor of the factory, usually from 10 to midnight. Experienced seamstresses could keep their machines in working order, but those who were new, inept, or very ill could not. To fix a broken machine, which was forged out of cast iron at a foundry inside Camp 14, Shin and other repairmen had to haul it on their backs to a repair shop upstairs. The extra labor incensed many of the repairmen, who took their anger out on seamstresses by grabbing their hair, slamming their heads against walls, and kicking them in the face. Foremen in the factory, who were prisoners chosen by guards for their toughness, generally looked the other way when seamstresses were beaten. They told Shin that fear encouraged production. Although he was still short and skinny, Shin was no longer a passive, malnourished, and torture-traumatized child. During his first year in the factory, he proved it to himself and to his co-workers in a confrontation with another sewing machine repairman. Gong Jin-soo was a hothead. Shin had watched him go into a rage when one of the seamstresses in Gong's stable broke the axle of a sewing machine. Gong kicked the woman in the face until she collapsed to the floor. When Gong demanded a feed dog, a crucial part of a sewing machine that controls stitch size by regulating the speed of fabric movement to the needle, from a seamstress who worked with Shin, she curtly refused. "Bitch, if a repairman asks for a part, you give it," Gong said. What are you looking at me with your eyes all raised? As Shin watched, Gong punched her in the face and bloodied her nose. Astonishing himself and his seamstresses, Shin lost his composure. He grabbed a large wrench and swung it as hard as he could, trying to crack open Gong's skull. The wrench crunched into his forearm, which Gong raised just in time to protect his head. Gong yelled and fell to the floor. The shift foreman, who had trained Shin, rushed over. He found Shin, wild-eyed and wrench in hand, standing over Gong, whose bloody arm had a lump on it the size of an egg. The foreman slapped Shin's face and took his wrench. The seamstresses returned to sewing. From then on, Gong kept his distance. The garment factory is a sprawling cluster of seven large buildings, all of which are visible on satellite photographs. Located near the Tadong River, its grounds lie at the entrance to Valley 2, not far from the hydroelectric dam and factories that make glassware and porcelain. During Shin's time at the garment factory, there were dormitories on the grounds for 2,000 seamstresses, as well as for 500 men who worked in sewing machine repair, garment design, plant maintenance, and shipping. The factory superintendent was the only Bowie-won on the site. All the other foremen, including the Chong Bang Jang, or head foreman, were prisoners. Working in the factory put Shin in close daily contact with several hundred women in their teens, 20s, and 30s. Some were strikingly attractive, and their sexuality created tension on the factory floor. Part of it was their ill-fitting uniforms. They had no bras and few wore underwear. Sanitary napkins were not available. As a 20-year-old virgin, Shin was nervous around these women. They interested him, but he worried about the camp rule that prescribed death for prisoners who had sexual relations without prior approval. Shin said he was careful not to get involved with any of the women, but the prohibition on sex meant nothing to the factory superintendent and the handful of favored prisoners who served as foremen. The superintendent, a guard in his 30s, wandered among the seamstresses like a buyer at a cattle auction. Shin watched him choose a different girl every few days, ordering her to clean his room, which was located inside the factory. Seamstresses not cleaning the superintendent's room were fair game for the chief foreman and other prisoners with supervisory jobs in the factory. Women had no choice but to comply. There was also something in it for them, at least in the short term. If they pleased the superintendent or one of the foremen, they could expect less work and more food. If they broke a sewing machine, they were not beaten. One seamstress who regularly cleaned the superintendent's room was Park Chun-young, whom Shin knew from secondary school and who operated a sewing machine that he maintained. She was 22 and exceptionally pretty. 4 months after she began spending afternoons in the superintendent's room, Shin heard from another former school friend that she was pregnant. Her condition was kept secret until her belly began to poke through her uniform. Then she disappeared. Shin learned how to tell from a sewing machine's sound what was wrong with it. He was less adept in lugging the bulky machines to the repair shop. In the summer of 2004, while carrying one up a flight of stairs on his back, it slipped from his grasp. The sewing machine tumbled down the stairwell, broken beyond repair. His immediate superior, the foreman who had been patient with Shin as he learned the ropes in the factory, slapped Shin a few times when he saw the ruined machine. He then reported the damage up the factory's chain of command. Sewing machines were considered more valuable than prisoners, and ruining one was regarded as a grave offense. A few minutes after he dropped the sewing machine, Shin was called into the office of the plant superintendent, along with the chief foreman and the floor foreman who had reported the incident. "What were you thinking?" the superintendent shouted at Shin. "Do you want to die? How could you be so weak that you lost your grip? You're always stuffing your face with food." "Even if you die, the sewing machine can't be brought back," the superintendent added. "Your hand is the problem. Cut his finger off." The chief foreman grabbed Shin's right hand and held it down on a table in the superintendent's office. With a kitchen knife, he hacked Shin's middle finger off just above the first knuckle. Shin's foreman helped him leave the superintendent's office and escorted him back to the factory floor. Later that night, the foreman took Shin to the camp's health center, where a prisoner who worked as a nurse soaked his finger in salt water, stitched it up, and wrapped it in cloth. That did not keep it from getting infected, but from his time in the underground cell, Shin remembered how Uncle had rubbed salted cabbage soup into his wounds. At mealtimes, Shin soaked his finger in soup. The infection did not spread into the bone, and within 3 months, new skin healed over the stumpy finger. For the first 2 days after the injury, Shin's foreman filled in on the factory floor. It was an unexpected gesture of concern that allowed Shin to recover. The kind foreman did not last long on the job. He disappeared, along with his wife, a few months after Shin dropped the sewing machine. Shin heard from other repairmen that the foreman's wife, while out working in the woods, had stumbled upon a secret execution in a mountain gorge. Before the foreman disappeared, he brought Shin a gift. "It's rice flour, and your father wants you to have it," the foreman said. At the mention of his father's name, Shin became angry. Although he had tried to repress it, the resentment he felt toward his mother and brother had grown since their deaths. It had poisoned his feelings for his father. Shin wanted nothing to do with him. "You eat it," Shin said. "Your father intended it for you," the foreman replied, looking puzzled. "Shouldn't you eat it?" Despite his hunger, Shin refused. With so many prisoners working so close together, the factory was a petri dish for snitching. A co-worker betrayed Shin a few weeks after he dropped the sewing machine. His shift had failed to meet the day's production quota and was required to do bitter humiliation work. Along with three other repairmen, Shin did not get back to his dormitory room until after midnight. They were all wildly hungry, and one suggested they raid the factory's vegetable garden, where there were cabbage, lettuce, cucumbers, eggplant, and radishes. It was raining and there was no moonlight. They figured the chances of being caught were low. They snuck outside, filled their arms with vegetables, and brought them back to their room, where they ate and fell asleep. In the morning, the four were called to the superintendent's office. Someone had reported their midnight meal. The superintendent whacked each of them on the head with a stick. He then told one repairman, Kang Man Bok, to leave the room. A snitch can smell a snitch. Shin instinctively knew Kang had informed. The superintendent ordered that rations for the three remaining men be cut in half for 2 weeks, and he clubbed them on the head a few more times. Returning to the factory, Shin noticed that Kang would not meet his eye. Soon, Shin was asked to spy on his fellow workers. The superintendent called him to his office and said that to wash away the sins of his mother and brother, he had to report wrongdoers. It took Shin 2 months before he found one. Lying sleepless on the floor one night, he watched as a roommate, a transport worker named Kang Chul Min, who was in his late 20s, got up and began mending his work trousers. He used a swatch of military uniform cloth to cover a hole in his pants. He apparently had stolen the cloth from the factory floor. The following morning, Shin went to the superintendent. "Teacher, I saw a stolen piece of cloth." "Really? Who had it?" "It was Kang Chul Min in my room." Shin worked late that night in the factory and was among the last of the sewing machine repairmen to walk into a 10 o'clock meeting of ideological struggle, a mandatory session of self-criticism. As he entered the room, he saw Kang Chul Min. He was on his knees and bound in chains. His bare back was covered with welts from a whip. His secret girlfriend, a seamstress whom Shin had heard rumors about, knelt beside him. She, too, was in chains. They remained kneeling in silence throughout the 90-minute meeting. When it ended, the superintendent ordered each worker to slap Kang and his girlfriend in the face before leaving the room. Shin slapped them both. He heard that they were then dragged outside and forced to kneel on a concrete floor for several more hours. The two never figured out who had reported the stolen cloth. Shin did his best to avoid their eyes. Chapter 13. Deciding Not to Snitch. The superintendent had another job for Shin. Park Young-chul, short and stout, with a shock of white hair, was an important new prisoner. He had lived abroad. His wife was well-connected. He knew senior people in the North Korean government. The superintendent ordered Shin to teach Park how to fix sewing machines and to become his friend. Shin was to report back on everything Park said about his past, his politics, and his family. "Park needs to confess," the superintendent said. "He's holding out on us." In October 2004, Shin and Park began spending 14 hours a day together in the garment factory. Park paid polite attention to Shin's instructions on sewing machine maintenance, Just as politely, he avoided questions about his past. Shin learned little. Then, after 4 weeks of near silence, Park surprised Shin with a personal question. "Sir, where is your home?"
"My home?" Shin said. "My home is here."
"I am from Pyongyang, sir," Park said. Park addressed Shin using honorific nouns and verb endings. In the Korean language, they signified the seniority and superiority of Shin the teacher over Park the apprentice. Park was a dignified man in his mid-40s, but the linguistic fussiness annoyed and embarrassed Shin. "I'm younger than you," Shin said. "Please drop the honorific with me."
"I will," said Park. "By the way," asked Shin, "where is Pyongyang?"
Shin's question stunned Park. The older man, though, did not laugh or make light of Shin's ignorance. He seemed intrigued by it. He carefully explained that Pyongyang, located about 50 miles south of Camp 14, was the capital of North Korea, the city where all the country's powerful people lived. The ice had been broken by Shin's naivete. Park began to talk about himself. He said he had grown up in a large, comfortable apartment in Pyongyang and had followed the privileged educational trajectory of North Korea's elites, studying in East Germany and the Soviet Union. After returning home, he had become chief of a Taekwondo training center in Pyongyang. In that high-profile job, Park said, he had met many of the men who ruled North Korea. Touching his oil-stained right hand to a sewing machine, Park said, "With this hand, I shook Kim Jong-il's hand." Park looked like an athlete. His hands were large and meaty. He was impressively strong, if a bit thick around the middle. But what impressed Shin was Park's decency. He did not make Shin feel stupid. He patiently attempted to explain what life was like outside Camp 14 and outside North Korea. So began a month-long one-on-one seminar that would forever change Shin's life. As they walked the factory floor, Park told Shin that the giant country next door was called China. Its people were rapidly getting rich. He said that in the South there was another Korea. In South Korea, he said, everyone was already rich. Park explained the concept of money. He told Shin about the existence of television and computers and mobile phones. He explained that the world was round. Much of what Park talked about, especially at the beginning, was difficult for Shin to understand, believe, or care about. Shin wasn't especially interested in how the world worked. What delighted him, what he kept begging Park for, were stories about food and eating, particularly when the main course was grilled meat. These were the stories that kept Shin up at night, fantasizing about a better life. Partly it was the grinding exhaustion of work in the factory. Meals were skimpy, hours were endless, and Shin was always hungry. But there was something more, something buried in Shin's memory from when he was 13 and struggling to recover from his burns in the underground prison. His aging cellmate had inflamed his imagination with tales of hearty meals. Uncle had dared Shin to dream about one day getting out of the camp and eating whatever he wanted. Freedom, in Shin's mind, was just another word for grilled meat. While the old man in the underground prison had eaten well in North Korea, Park's gustatory adventures were global. He described the enchantments of chicken, pork, and beef in China, Hong Kong, Germany, England, and the former Soviet Union. The more Shin listened to these stories, the more he wanted out of the camp. He ached for a world where an insignificant person like himself could walk into a restaurant and fill his stomach with rice and meat. He fantasized about escaping with Park because he wanted to eat like Park. Intoxicated by what he heard from the prisoner he was supposed to betray, Shin made perhaps the first free decision of his life. He chose not to snitch. It marked a major shift in his calculations about how to survive. Based on Shin's experience, snitching paid. It saved him from the executioners who killed his mother and brother. After the execution, it may have been the reason his secondary school teacher made sure he had food, put a stop to the hazing, and assigned him to an easy job on the pig farm. But Shin's decision to honor Park's confidences did not signify new insight into the nature of right and wrong. Looking back, Shin views his behavior as fundamentally selfish. If he informed on Park, he could have earned an extra serving of cabbage. Perhaps he might have been promoted to foreman with a special dispensation to prey upon the seamstresses. But Park's stories were much more valuable to Shin. They had become an essential and energizing addiction, changing his expectations about the future and giving him the will to plan for it. He believed he would go mad without hearing more.
In his reports to the superintendent, Shin found himself telling a wonderfully liberating lie. Park, he said, had nothing to say. A decade earlier in the underground prison, Shin's aging cellmate had dared to talk about food outside the camp. But Uncle had never talked about himself or his politics. He was careful, suspicious, and withholding. He guessed Shin was an informer and did not trust him. Shin took no offense. He saw it as normal. Trust was a good way to get shot. But after Park's initial reticence, he was not suspicious. In the apparent belief that Shin was as trustworthy as he was ignorant, Park told his life story. Park said he lost his position as head of Taekwondo training in Pyongyang in 2002 after squabbling with a mid-level apparatchik who apparently snitched on him to higher-ups in the government. Without a job, Park traveled north to the border with his wife, where they illegally crossed into China and stayed with his uncle for 18 months. They intended to return to Pyongyang, where they had left behind a teenage child who lived with Park's parents. While in China, Park listened daily to radio broadcasts from South Korea. He paid close attention to coverage of Wang Jang-yop, a principal architect of North Korea's ideology and the highest-ranking official ever to defect. Wang, who fled in 1997, had become a celebrity in Seoul. As Shin and Park did their rounds in the garment factory, Park explained that Wang had criticized Kim Jong-il for turning North Korea into a corrupt, feudal state. Kim's government dispatched agents in 2010 to try to assassinate Wang. The agents, however, were arrested in Seoul, and Wang died of natural causes that year at 87. Park left China and returned to North Korea in the summer of 2003, along with his wife and a baby son born in China. He wanted to get back to Pyongyang in time to vote in the August election for the Supreme People's Assembly, the rubber-stamp parliament of North Korea. Elections in North Korea are empty rituals. Candidates are chosen by the Korean Workers' Party and run without opposition. But Park feared if he missed the vote, the government would notice his absence, declare him to be a traitor, and send his family to a labor camp. Voting in North Korea is not mandatory, but the government keeps close track of those who do not show up. At the border, North Korean authorities detained Park and his family. He tried to convince them that he wasn't a defector, that he had merely been visiting family in China and was coming home to vote. Authorities did not buy it. They accused him of being a convert to Christianity and a spy for South Korea. After several rounds of interrogation, Park and his wife and son were sent to Camp 14. Park was assigned to the camp's textile factory in the autumn of 2004. When Shin met him, Park was furious with himself for returning to North Korea. His foolishness had cost him his freedom, and as he told Shin, it would soon cost him his wife. She was divorcing him. She came from a prominent family in Pyongyang with strong party connections, Park said, and she was trying to convince camp guards that she had been a loyal and submissive wife while her husband was a political criminal. Despite Park's anger at the rottenness of North Korea, at his wife, at himself, he always carried himself with dignity, especially when it was time to eat. Shin found this utterly amazing. Everyone he knew in the camp behaved like a panicked animal at mealtimes. Park, even when hungry, did not. When Shin caught rats in the factory, Park insisted on patience. He refused to allow Shin to eat them until they'd found a furnace or flame where a rat could be spread out on the head of a shovel and cooked properly. Park also could be a blithe spirit. In Shin's view, he sometimes took this a bit too far. Take, for example, Park's singing. In the middle of a night shift on the floor of the factory, Park alarmed Shin by bursting into song. "Hey, what do you think you're doing?" Shin asked, fearing that a foreman might hear. "Singing," Park said. "Stop at once," Shin told him. Shin had never sung a song. His only exposure to music had been on the farm, when trucks with loudspeakers played martial music while prisoners picked weeds. To Shin, singing seemed unnatural and insanely risky. "Would you like to sing with me?" Park asked. Shin vigorously shook his head and waved his hands, trying to silence Park. "Who would hear me at this hour?" Park said. "Sing after me this once." Shin refused. Park asked why he was so afraid of a little song when he was willing to hear seditious stories about how Kim Jong-il was a thief and North Korea was a hellhole. Shin explained that he tolerated such things because Park had the good sense to whisper. "I wish you wouldn't sing," Shin said. Park agreed not to, but a few nights later he again broke into song and offered to teach Shin the lyrics. Although dubious and afraid, Shin listened and sang with Park, but quietly. The lyrics of Song of the Winter Solstice, which recent defectors say